Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. We have something very special planned for you this week. We have taken interviews that I've done with World War II veterans on my America's Veterans Story Show and reworked these so that you can hear these stories this week during Memorial Day. This is such an important week that we remember those that gave or were willing to give everything so that we can live in liberty and freedom and prosperity. I hope that you enjoy each and every one of these shows.
This show precipitated from a trip that I took in 2016 with a group from the Denver Police Activities League that accompanied four D-Day veterans back to Normandy for the 72nd anniversary of the D-Day landings. Returned back stateside, realizing that each soldier's story is unique and that we needed to capture these and retell these stories, and hence this show was born. I am very honored to have on the line with me Major General John C. Ron Jr. He was actually with the 5th Ranger Battalion at D-Day, Omaha Beach. General Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm here.
I'm glad that you're here. I did some research. Your life story is a remarkable story. Let's start at the beginning. You come from a military family, correct?
Correct. I'm an Army brat.
And you attended West Point?
I attended West Point, graduated in January of 1943.
And after you graduated, what happened?
Well, after I graduated, we went to Fort Belvoir to the engineer school and had a refresher course in engineers or engineering, military engineering. We'd had quite a bit of military engineering at the military academy, but there were a few things that we had to brush up on and learn, new things, particularly pneumatic bridges and things of that sort, which we had not had at West Point. So the time that we spent there, which was, I think, was about 3 weeks, I beg your pardon, 6 weeks, was very, very useful for us. After that, went across the street to the Engineer Replacement Training Center, where I was a platoon leader of an engineer replacement training company. As a platoon leader, I was very lucky. I got the entire St. Louis University football team in my platoon. They all went down to the recruiting station and enlisted the same day and ended up in my platoon. So I had a bunch of eager young types that were no problem at all.
Wow. What happened after? And actually, General Ron, explain to our listeners what an engineering school is. What is it exactly that they're teaching you to do?
Well, they teach military engineering. There are two phases for it. They call it vertical and horizontal. The vertical phase, you learn how to make buildings or build buildings, and they don't really teach you much about that in the engineer school. The horizontal engineering they teach you is to make roads, bridges, dams, fortifications, lay mine fields, put up barbed wire, all of those military activities that are sort of a subset of engineering activities. So that's what military engineering is. In peace time life, the engineers control the Mississippi River, sharing the duties with the Coast Guard. I've forgotten the exact split between the two organizations, but that's what we used to call rivers and harbors. And it's a very interesting particular part of the trade. And the people who do those things have to be very, very intelligent, because there's a great deal of calculation done. And if you calculate wrong, your bridge, your dam, your water pipe, whatever it is not going to work.
You know, I never actually put the two together regarding the Mississippi River
and the Corps of Engineer. Here I am. You can always learn something new. So thank you, General Ron. I probably shouldn't have admitted that on the air, but I think it's important to realize that. Let's continue on with the story. So you have this whole football team that is part of your platoon. What happens after that?
Well, I was there for approximately 6 weeks again, and then went down to Fort Benning, Georgia, where I was born, I might add, and joined the 10th Armored Division. I was assigned to the 55th Armored Engineer Battalion and ended up, of all things, in the bridge company, which was a pneumatic bridge company. We had a lot of pneumatic pontoons and metal structure that goes on the pontoons so that you can get an armored division across a river. And it was very interesting. I'd had only a little bit of that in the engineer school just a short time before. I did well enough there that they gave me the Armored Engineer Reconnaissance Platoon, and that was a regular engineer, armored engineer platoon, but it had four extra jeeps for the reconnaissance part with non-commissioned officers to man each of those with a driver, of course. So it was a very, very classy organization to be a part of. From Fort Benning, and we were only in Fort Benning for a little over a month, we went to the Tennessee Maneuver Area and participated in approximately, I would guess it was about 6 weeks of maneuvers. We were the armored division on the Blue Force. And the very first thing that happened there was that the Corps, the Blue Corps, took the reconnaissance squadron of the division and made them Corps reconnaissance, and suddenly my little old engineer platoon of some 50 men had to do the same job that the reconnaissance squadron had done with 350 men and about 50 or 60 vehicles. It was exciting, believe me, and it was also a great deal of fun. From there, I volunteered for and was accepted in the 5th Ranger Infantry Battalion, which was being organized at Camp Forest, Tennessee. And I joined them on the 1st of September as a platoon leader in Company C of the 5th Battalion, and soon moved to headquarters as the training officer. And the next thing I knew, by about 2 months, I found myself as the headquarters company commander of the 5th Ranger Battalion, and I held that for till after the German Bulge attacks in 1944.
Wow. So you said September of... Okay, 1st of September, was that? That was 43. Okay. Okay. Take it from there. Then what happened?
September 43. Well, as I say, we went through a great deal of good, solid Ranger training at Camp Forest. We next went to Fort Pierce, Florida, where we attended the Scout and Raider School that the Navy had there at Fort Pierce, and there we got our small boat training, amphibious training, and things like that. We were there till probably the beginning of November. Good hurricane season stuff.
Sure.
Weather was always cloudy, always stormy. And I learned that Florida permitted beer sales, whiskey sales on Sunday, but they wouldn't allow beer sales on Sunday. That was the big piece of knowledge I picked up at Fort Pierce. after we got through with our amphibious training, we went to Fort Dix and continued with Ranger training until they found a slot for us at Fort Kilmer, which was the port of embarkation, and we moved to the port of embarkation and did very little training there. That was where the Army was nice enough to allow almost every single individual to go home for a week on leave and things like that to get things straightened out before we went overseas. We boarded our first ship. Actually, we didn't board our first ship. Our first ship had a whole bunch of fires below decks, and that was the Ile de France. And so they had to put us on an entirely different boat. And we went from the port of New York to, I've forgotten which one it was, Birmingham, I would guess. But in any event, we went to England, and we docked there on January 19th, 1944, which was precisely 1 year from my graduation from West Point. So now you've had a summary of my first year as a commissioned officer.
Okay, so this would be January 1944. Hitler knows that the Allies are going to, at some point, try to get a toehold on the European continent. What is happening? Because there's preparation, obviously, between now and D-Day. So what is going on at that particular point in time, General Ron?
Well, I was the headquarters company commander, and I assisted the supply officer of the battalion in equipping the battalion. I mean, we had to get our trucks, we had to get our stoves for the mess hall, we had to get our rifles, our machine guns, our bazookas, you name it. We had to equip the entire battalion, and at the same time, the battalion was training, very severe training, rifle marksmanship, land navigation, and a tremendous amount of physical conditioning, because the Ranger had to be in absolutely perfect physical condition to sustain himself in combat with the missions that we were given. So we trained in Leinster, England for a couple of months. We then moved up to Scotland, where we trained with the commandos. We were had commando instructors, and we actually had the same ships that would take us into Normandy and the same boats. By that I mean landing craft assault. And we trained with the same, essentially the same people. Of course, because the invasion wouldn't be for 3 or 4 months, the personnel might change, so we didn't get the exact same coxswain in our boat that we trained with in Scotland. But the British that we trained with were essentially the same ones that took us into Normandy, and believe me, they were experienced. They'd been through 3 or 4 landings themselves, and they were just as brave as hell.
Wow. General Ron, let's go to break. Let's take an early break on this so that we can continue with the story. Before we go to break, just want to give a shout out to one of my great partners, and that is Hooters Restaurants, located here in the metro area. They have locations in Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. They have game day specials available Monday through Thursday, 6 p.m. to close, and all day Saturday and Sunday for dine-in. They also have to-go specials, and if you're having friends over, they've got a fabulous party pack to go as well. So for more information, go to HootersColorado.com. That's HootersColorado.com, and we'll be right back with General Ron.
It's time for more of America's Veteran Stories with your host, Kim Munson.
And on the line with me is a good friend of mine, a valued partner, and that is Karen Levine. She is an award-winning realtor with RE/MAX Alliance right here in the metro area. I've known her for many years. She is truly a professional. She's got really great negotiating skills. So, Karen Levine, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Kim.
You know, I know that you have a heart for these veteran stories just like I do. I so thank you for being a partner on this show. Why do you think that's important?
Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me to have the privilege to be part of the show. And for me, it's important because our veterans have been willing to potentially sacrifice their life to achieve freedom and preserve freedom here in America. And, you know, they have a heart for America, as you and I do, and their stories just are amazing. And when I have an opportunity to help a veteran with the purchase of a home or selling their home, it's just a privilege that I take very seriously. And the nice thing is that the one thing government has done well is offered veterans the opportunity to buy a home with no money down through a VA loan. And I have great lenders like Lauren in my corner who understand that. So we're a great team, and we encourage those veterans out there that maybe haven't taken advantage of buying a home, that there is opportunity out there, and we are certainly ready, willing, and able to help them as they have helped our country.
Well, most definitely. And people can reach you, Karen Levine, at 303-877-7516. 303-877-7516. Karen Levine, I so appreciate you. And you've been in the business a long time, and you really care about people. You helped them on the buy and sell side. So thank you so much.
Well, you're most welcome, and we look forward to talking to your listeners again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That is americasveteranstories.com. I am so honored to have on the line with me Major General John Ron Jr. We're going through his experience as an Army Ranger, the 5th Ranger Battalion. And at this particular point in time, where it's before D-Day. General Ron, let's take it from there. You've been doing the training with the commandos on the landing craft, and this is the months leading up to D-Day. Is there anything in particular you want our listeners to know about that time frame?
No, except the training was very severe. It was all done with live ammunition. We had a MASH unit with us. It wasn't as big as MASH 4077, but we did have two surgeons and a group of probably 12 to 15 technicians and nurses to take care of the wounded that we got in the training. And we did have quite a few casualties and made good use of that surgical team. After we left Scotland, we went to the Assault Training Center down in Bronson, England, fairly near Barnstable, which I think might be a better known city, and went through the Assault Training Center there. Again, this was for us a live ammunition training period, and we took a few casualties from ricochets and things like that. Subsequent to that training, we moved to the port of, I'll call it, debarkation in Dorchester.
Okay.
I had to go through the spelling before I could get the word. In any event, Dorchester, we were in Camp D4. They must have had 10, 15 camps around Dorchester. And here we were sealed in behind a double chain fence with guards and guard dogs between the two fences to make sure that we had no contact at all with the civilian populace or anybody else for that matter. Really tightly sealed in. From there, we went on a major exercise called Fabius. This was like May 1st through the 3rd or 4th of 1944. And here we had several divisions involved in the invasion of the southern coast of England. We learned a lot of lessons, sorely needed lessons, because we were able to take advantage of them in the next remaining month before the actual invasion. Very, very severe training, very good as far as we were concerned. And at that point, we went back to Dorchester, to D4. And from there on, we spent almost the entire day working over maps and sand tables and aerial photos of the area that we would be landing. It got so that we knew exactly everything that there was to know about that coastline, but there were no names on the maps or sand tables or anything like that. It was just the map without a single name on it. It wasn't until we got aboard the actual boats, and my group loaded on the 1st of January, we got on the boats. They gave us the maps with the names on it.
Now, you said 1st of January. Did you mean 1st of June or 1st of January?
I must have meant the 1st of June.
Okay. Okay.
But I never make mistakes.
I didn't think it was a mistake. I thought we just needed a clarification. How's that?
That's pretty good. That gets me off the hook.
Hey, just a quick.
In any event, we got aboard the boats. I was aboard the HMS Baldwin, Prince Baldwin, and at that particular point in time, we continued rather strenuous physical training, and we studied the maps, we studied the sand tables, we studied the aerial photos, we attended to our equipment, made sure everything was working fine, the knives, the fighting knives were honed down after hour and hour of stoning and things like that. Finally, we got the word that we were going on the morning of June 5th. So we left Portland Harbor and sailed out into the English Channel. And when we got to the English Channel, they called the whole thing off. So we dribbled back into Portland Harbor and waited and waited. And finally, on June 5th, they said, okay, we're going to go tomorrow. So it's approximately 4:30. We sailed out of Weymouth Harbor. I beg your pardon, Portland Harbor. Weymouth and Portland were really one harbor separated by a gigantic boom that made it into two harbors. It was easier to manage that way. Weymouth Harbor was just too big to manage as a single harbor. So, anyway, we went out of the Portland end and sailed our way through the Eye of the Needle. There was a small point in the English Channel. Every vessel going into France had to sail through or between two buoys, and that was called the Eye of the Needle. And the reason why had to do with the Germans having laid minefields, sea minefields, and the cleared lanes could be reached only by going through the Eye of the Needle. So we all went through there and finally dropped anchor about 3 a.m. off the coast of France, some 12 miles out. loaded into our assault boats and went on in toward La Plante de Auch, which was our plan A. I better tell you about the overall battle plan for the Rangers.
Okay.
At this point, because it doesn't make much sense unless you know what we were supposed to be doing. We were divided into three Ranger forces, Ranger Force A, Ranger Force B, and Ranger Force C. Ranger Force A consisted of three companies of the 2nd Battalion, 2nd Ranger Battalion, and they're the heroes who climbed the cliffs at Plante de Auch.
Okay.
Ranger Force B consisted of companies, Company C of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, and it had a mission to land near Vierville, climb some cliffs, and take out some German batteries on a thing called Pointe de la Perche. And that company, they were the first ones to the top in the invasion. First ones who made it off the beach. Fought all day, great heroism shown by all. Ranger Force C, which was the one I was in, consisted of companies A and B of the 2nd Ranger Battalion and the entire six companies plus headquarters of the 5th Ranger Battalion. And our job was, if we could, we were to follow Task Force A up the cliffs and give them the equivalent of 9 Ranger companies instead of 3 Ranger companies to carry out the succeeding missions. It didn't work out that way, so we had to follow Plan B. Very unhappily, Ranger Force A, which was to go climb the cliffs, was led to the wrong point. So they were over half an hour, close to 40 minutes late, getting to the cliffs. We were on a fairly tight timetable, and we were ordered to stop waiting for them and to go to Plan B after a half an hour of waiting. And so we went to Vierville, to land at Vierville, where landing control waved us off and said, casualties are too severe. Omaha Dog Green is closed. So we shifted over. They told us to land on Dog White. We shifted over approximately 1,000 yards to the boundary between Dog White and Dog Green. Our first wave of some 5 landing craft, consisting of headquarters and A and B of the 2nd Ranger Battalion. They landed essentially at the boundary of Omaha Dog Green and Dog White, and they were met with a tremendous amount of rifle and machine gun fire, mortar fire, and were being cut to pieces. And my battalion commander, perhaps he was probably 600-700 yards out watching through field glasses, made the classic statement, I'm not going to lose my battalion on that beach. So he persuaded the British to move to our left, and we actually landed on Dog Red Beach, about 800 yards away. And there we were lucky enough to have 3 factories that allowed us to cross bloody Omaha with less than 5 casualties.
Oh, my gosh.
Unbelievable for a force of 450 Rangers to land on a hot beach and have only 4 or 5 casualties on the beach. And I'll explain that to you. First, the hills, the bluffs, were on fire in front of us on Dog Red, where we landed. The Germans couldn't see us through the smoke and flames. Even better yet, the flames drove a lot of them out of their positions. and they had to abandon their machine guns and mortars because they just didn't have time because of the flames. And the fire and ammunition just do not go at all well together.
You think?
So the Germans above us, who should have been butchering us, half of them weren't there, and the rest of them couldn't see us. As far as fire from the left, there was a little nose on the bluffs, and the people, the German defenders on that side, were on the other side of that nose, and they couldn't see us. So the only people that could see us were to our right, and they really poured in the ammunition over us. But at that particular point, I have to tell you that the French had constructed breakwaters that came out from the seawall where we landed, 15 of them, and those breakwaters were made of big, large, heavy rocks piled sort of in a triangular type of seawall, and they were about 4 feet high, and if you got between two seawalls, you could hide from the ammunition that was being shot at you from the right. So we didn't take any casualties that way either. I had one man wounded in my group of about 30 or 40 headquarters types, my runner right behind me. But we got across that beach without very much in the way of casualties. The German fortifications, if you want to call them that, consisted of all kinds of barriers out in the water, which we managed to maneuver through, and then consisted of barbed wire. Most people use the term double apron, and that's the way I remember it, very similar to American double apron wire. We had to blow the wire with Bangalore torpedoes. The Ranger Battalion, we blew four holes in the wire and were able to pass our entire six companies that remained through the wire up the bluffs with relatively minor fighting up the bluffs because of the fire and the smoke, and got to the top into the hedgerow country, and then began the difficult job of defeating the German armies in, as the French call it, Le Bocage, the hedgerow company, country.
General Ron, let's stop right there and go to break. When we come back, let's talk about what happened in the hedgerow country. We'll be right back with General Ron.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
God bless America.
On the line with me is Lauren Levy. He is a mortgage specialist with Polygon Financial Group, and he is a really valued partner of America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Lauren Levy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kim. Good to be here. Thank you.
You know, you are a valued partner of the America's Veteran Stories show. Why is it important to you to make sure that these stories are kept alive?
Well, I think number one for me, it's you always want to feel like veterans are given the respect that they've earned and they deserve. And you hear a lot of things about different programs that the government does, and some may do well, some may don't do well. And especially here in Denver, we've heard stories of things like the VA hospital being sort of a nightmare to get built, and it's too bad for those guys, although now it looks like it went well. But VA loans, and where I come into play, are one of the best things the government has done, and they're just a great thing for veterans. And a great opportunity for them to take advantage of crazy low rates, lower than even the mortgage rates you hear about normally. And it's nice to be able to help these people save even more money than the regular consumer.
Now, can there be refinances on VA loans?
Absolutely. VA loans do, you can do regular refinances just to lower your rate. You can take cash out of your home all the way up to the full value of the home, in addition to be able to buy houses with no money down. So it's really got some benefits that most loans don't offer for the non-veteran community or non-active duty. You don't have to be a veteran. You just have to qualify.
Okay. And are you still doing the great deal that you had as far as people want to take a look at refinancing, that you'll pay for their appraisal since you are sponsoring the America's Veteran Story Show?
Absolutely. So there's a really good opportunity for everybody, but especially for veterans, because if someone contacts me, I will, if we do the loan and we move forward and an appraisal is required, I will pay for the appraisal for the people that come through your show, Kim, yes. And so it's a really good opportunity for veterans or anybody who has a DD-214. It's a form that we use for veterans from the VA. If they have that eligibility, we can help them get an incredibly low rate on a refi or take money out of their home if they need it at this time. Or buy a home, any of them, and we'll always cover the appraisal, yes.
Okay, that is a great deal. Thank you, Lauren. I really appreciate that. So how can people get more information and contact you?
So the best way to call, best way to contact is just to call my cell phone at 303-880-8881. We do have a website, polyfigroup.com, with information there. But the easiest way is just to call. And I can take down most of the information that we need to get started right there on that initial phone call.
Okay. And again, that number is 303-880-8881. Lauren Levy, I just love having you as a partner of the show. Thank you so much. And on the line with me is a valued new sponsor of America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, Hal Van Herke. He is one of the owners of Castlegate.com, Castlegate Knives. It's a specialty knife store. It's a family-owned business located right here in Colorado, in Sedalia, Colorado. Hal Van Herke, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Kim. Glad to be here.
And, you know, our veteran stories, our military, are so important. And I went out to Castlegate, and really it's an impressive store. You have all kinds of different knives for collectors, kitchen sets for the sportsmen, but you also have knives for the military. So let's talk a little bit about that, Hal.
Yeah, we're a full-line knife store. We carry knives ranging from basic pocket knives all the way to elaborate collector's knives and everything in between. But one of the things that we really focus on is what we would call deployment quality or military quality knives that you know you're going to be able to depend on when you're deployed or you're downrange. And if you needed to depend on them, or if you needed them when your life depended on it, you would be able to count on it to be there for you. So, and that's kind of the standard we have for many of our knives. But some of the key brands that we really work with that military personnel appreciate, for example, is Spartan Blades, which is owned and operated by two retired Army Special Forces officers. And Spartan manufactures a whole range of various fixed blade knives, ranging from utility knives or knives that you didn't use in the field, as well as defensive knives that you can carry on your kit. And then on the kind of a different end of the spectrum, we also work very closely with Microtech, which is the leading producer of automatic knives in the United States, and we carry their entire line of out-the-front knives as well. And then we carry, several other brands such as Medford, Emerson, Hinderer, and a number of others that are designed specifically for the military. So frequently they have more testing, stronger materials, no excess frills that you don't need and everything that you do.
So just a question, Hal, doesn't the military issue knives, or is it that maybe people want higher quality that are in the military, or why is that important to somebody?
Yeah, I think that it all depends on what branch of the service you're in, what your circumstances are, and what units you're in, about what you might have issued to you. But everybody's needs are different. Everybody's preferences are different. And a lot of times, since a knife is so fundamental to something you use daily when you're deployed, it's not just for defensive purposes or as a weapon, but just as a utility knife. There's a lot of personal preference that is involved, and if your unit allows you to make those choices, then it's one of the first things we see a lot of people, you know, choose to personalize and to carry what, mm-hmm. what they are comfortable with. Yeah. And certainly the quality you get, if you're going to pay for it and paying for it yourself, the quality you're going to get is going to be higher than what you're issued.
You know, I've interviewed a whole bunch of different World War II veterans, and the paratroopers that I talked to, particularly that jumped in, either at Market Garden, but really on D-Day, is, you know, their adrenaline was so, you know, just so on fire. And they had quick releases to get out of their chutes when they came in. But almost, I think, all of them used the knife that they had to cut themselves out of those parachutes. And so I can see why it would be important to have, you know, something that's dependable, something that really works, and something that somebody is comfortable with. So I would recommend that people go out to the store, because it is really impressive. You've got a website. It's castlegate.com. How's the best way for people to reach you, Hal?
For now, in our we're a small family-owned company, and we've been working on our website for to upgrade it to a new website, so it's still under construction, taking our time. But you can still reach us at castlegate.com, and you can see what type of brands we carry. The brands are all still listed there, et cetera. The inventory is not accurate at this point. But the best way to reach us, and especially if you're in the military, we can help you find the right knife, is to call us at 303-214-4303. The number again is 303-214-4303, Castlegate Knife and Tool. Let us know that you're a veteran and you're getting deployed, or whether you're not being deployed. If you're military, we do a 10% discount on anything in the store. Certain brands have even deeper discounts for military, and we prioritize people getting ready for deployment to get their knives out to them immediately.
Well, Hal Van Herke, thank you so much for what you do, and thank you so much for becoming a partner with America's Veteran Stories.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute, to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
From the mountains to the prairies to the ocean.
Welcome back to America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website. That is AmericasVeteranStories.com. I am honored to be talking with Major General John C. Ron Jr. He's 98 years old. He was at Normandy, France, D-Day, Omaha Beach, June 6, 1944, with the 5th Ranger Army Battalion. General Ron, this is an absolutely fascinating story, how you've gotten across bloody Omaha, and you're now in the beautiful hedgerow country of Normandy, France. But the hedgerows pose significant challenges for the Allies as they were making their way into France. Tell us about that.
Well, first thing, a hedgerow. We had expected to see hedgerows like they have in England, beautiful manicured hedges, and which would make no military obstacles at all. But what we found was that a hedgerow in France or in Normandy was totally different. Hundreds of years earlier, the French had partitioned out the countryside in rather large farms. And when I say large farms, we're talking 200, 300, 500 yards. We're not talking little farms like 30 or 40 yards or anything like that. Well, when they plowed, they would run into stones and stumps, and they would pull them out and pile them at the boundary of their property. So these walls of rocks and stumps used to grow and grow and grow over the centuries, and as they plowed, spoiled dirt worked its way into the rocks. Birds and farmers would cast seeds into the soil that was in the rocks, and before you knew it, you had small trees growing. So the hedgerow was a significant obstacle, with rather large trees growing out of the top, usually. Probably 4, 5, 6 feet of rock, and the roots of the trees going down to hold the rocks together. It was a very difficult thing. Tanks would plow into them at full speed and bounce. The hedgerow held. It wasn't until about a week in Normandy that some brilliant engineer sergeant said, "Hey, we got a lot of metal down here on the beach that comes from the obstacles the Germans had out there in the water. Why don't we cut that metal up and make like saw blades and put it on the front of tanks, and you can run the tanks into the hedgerow, have them shift right, shift left, and they will cut all those roots, and then they can plow right through the hedgerow," which they did. So that solved the problem of mobility in the hedgerow area. But for the troops themselves, for those first few days, we were lucky, very lucky. Harvest had not occurred. So in most of the farms, there was a substantial growth of crop. And most of the crop was a grass-type crop that went up about 3 or 4 feet. A lot of it were shrubs that would go up 2 or 3 feet. And we found very quickly that when the Germans would fire on us as we were going across the farm, you could drop down into the crop and totally disappear. The machine gunner shooting at us wouldn't have the slightest idea where we were. You could maneuver through that grass or through those that shrubbery, get over to the edge of the hedgerow, cross the hedgerow, and come up behind the Germans. And that particular tactic worked very, very well. That was how we handled the hedgerow. They slowed us down, but they didn't stop us. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. I did not realize that the hedgerows, I appreciate you explaining it. It's beautiful. But that would be formidable to try to get through. But American ingenuity took a little bit of time, but our soldiers figured out how to do that. What happens after that? What's your mission? What are you supposed to be doing now that you're in the hedgerow country?
Well, we're supposed to relieve the 2nd Ranger Battalion at Pointe d'Oc. And when I say relieve, that means to fight our way there. And then reinforced those three companies to accomplish the rest of the Ranger mission. And to do that, we had to get to Vierville, which was about a mile away. It took us quite a bit of time to get there because the Germans had machine guns in all the hedgerows surrounding the roads. So we had to eliminate them to get into Vierville. We got into Vierville and ran into some fortifications there, which held us up, but they wouldn't have held us up too long. But as we were organizing or reorganizing to proceed to Pointe d'Oc, which was now about 5 miles away, as we were organizing to do that, the 29th Division Command Structure, who were our commanders at that point, told us, "No, do not go to Pointe d'Oc to relieve them. We need you to help hold the beachhead." So we dug ourselves in and prepared for a night of German counterattacks, which, by the way, did not occur. And the next morning, the German counterattacks did occur, but a single battalion-sized task force moved out and moved about 5 miles to a little town of Saint-Pierre-Église, not Saint-Mère-Église, but Saint-Pierre-Église. We got there, and artillery, German artillery, which was very, very accurate and very good, stopped us cold. I think we could have relieved Plant Ock at that point in time, but instead, 29th Division ordered us to go into battle positions, night battle positions around Saint-Père-Église, and be prepared for German armored attacks. And I was very happily doing my job when the commander came over and said, I have been ordered back to Vierville with the tanks, and you're in command, and goodbye. And with that, he and the executive officer departed with the 8 tanks, leaving me a headquarters company commander in command of a company of infantry that was in pretty good shape, a shattered infantry battalion that probably didn't have a company size in it, 2 Ranger companies, no tanks, no real anti-tank weapons except a couple of bazookas and rifle grenades, waiting for a German armored counterattack on us. It didn't happen.
Wow. What happened? Do you know why? What happened?
Well, I think that the Germans thought that the Rangers at Plant d'Oc were the main effort of the invasion, and therefore they were counterattacking Plant d'Oc, which is probably the reason why we had made no attempt to relieve Plant d'Oc, because there was a German counterattack going on. And the Germans were directing their forces at Plant d'Oc and did not have sufficient strength or time to attack Saint-Pierre-Dumont.
General Ron, would you tell our listeners what happened to the Rangers over at Point d'Oc?
Yes. As I said earlier, they were led to the wrong point, to Plant de la Perse. And that happens to be about 3 to 4 miles from Plant d'Oc. When they discovered that, Colonel Rutter, who was in command of the 3 companies, had them turned to the right, and they sailed along the coast at about 1,000 yards off the coast. And, of course, all secrecy was lost. All organization was lost. The people, the Germans on the cliffs, were shooting at them the whole 4 miles. Fortunately, 2 of the accompanying boats had pretty big artillery pieces aboard, so that when they discovered any German machine gun positions, they just shelled them and managed to get through with very light casualties. But the original plan to land at Plant d'Oc and assault the cliffs was very carefully planned. 2 companies on one side of the cliffs, 1 company on the other. But now they couldn't do that. They couldn't waste the time to get a company around to the other side. So everybody, helter-skelter, had to land. Units were intermixed, and they only assaulted one side of the cliffs, and the Germans, of course, by then were waiting for them. They had aboard each of the LCAs, landing craft assault, they had aboard each of them 6 grapnel, rocket-propelled grapnel throwers. And when they were about 100 yards out, the command was given to fire the grapnels. Well, unfortunately, you know this, it was very stormy. It had been raining for 3 or 4 days. The hemp rope were all waterlogged, and all the grapnels fell short of the cliff. One lieutenant, who was a little late in firing his grapnels, noticed this and called off the grapnel firing until he grounded down, and then he said, fire the grapnels, and all of his were secured. So they had 6 ropes up the cliff. And on those 6 ropes, plus rope ladders, plus athleticism and good cliff climbing techniques, They got up the cliffs. The first man was on top of the cliffs from touchdown of the landing craft, was on top of the cliff in less than a minute.
Really?
But he cheated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he cheated. The Air Force, or Air Corps in those days, the Air Corps had been bombing Plant Ock regularly, not any more than any other place, because they didn't want to give away that that was where the landings would be. But Plant Ock got pretty heavy bombings. One bomb had hit right near the edge of the cliff and blown what I'll call a half crater.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine it.
I think I saw it when I was there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, you would have.
Uh-huh.
And below it, of course, there was a lot of spoil from the thing. So the guy ran up about 20 feet of spoil. He then climbed about 50 feet of cliff and was in the bomb crater. And was able to throw some ropes back, and before he knew it, he was joined by three or four guys, and by the minute, the Ranger force on top of the cliffs was growing. In other parts, they put up the extension ladders and climbed up on extension ladders. Many of them were using just plain old mountain climbing techniques to work their way up to the top, and before you knew it, they had, of the 250-man force, they probably had 200 of them on top of the cliffs, and they were able to subdue the Germans very quickly, went to accomplish their missions, which was the destruction of six German, they were Schneider howitzers. No, they weren't. They were GPF guns, able to knock those guns out, only to find that they were telephone poles, not guns. The Germans had moved the guns to a field that was probably 2 miles away, and they then got them. The Rangers got themselves together and carried out their second mission, which was to block the main coastal road between Cherbourg and Vierville, or the Omaha Beach area.
Okay.
And hang on there.
General Ron, we actually are out of time on this show. This is a cliffhanger, no pun intended, for sure. I would love to schedule additional interviews about your remarkable career. So let's do that, and we'll get you on the schedule to continue with your story. This has just been absolutely fascinating, and I so appreciate it, General Ron.
Well, you're most welcome. You have my phone number.
And we will be in touch on that.
Okie doke.
Okay, and my friends, what remarkable stories. We stand on the shoulders of giants. And my friends, God bless you, and God bless America. And I don't want